You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Brad Loncar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Chris Garabedian, Grace Cologne, and Eric Schmidt. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. And Josh, I'm going to start with you with a couple of data events that were in the news. And the first one is in the myasthenia gravis space, which, you know, has really been in focus a lot lately. Argenx has become a $25 billion company, with that being their first approval with their neonatal Fc receptor drug. And the news this week was that Roche had some data from an IL-6 program called Enspryng. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this was a very highly anticipated data set, in part because some of the emerging literature for the IL-6 antibodies suggest that they're really good, almost as good as, if not better than, the FcRns in reducing autoantibody titers. And you can envision that effect along with an additional anti-inflammatory kicker from IL-6. And so there were some investors who were, and myself included, who thought we could see something remarkable from this program, as good as, if not better than, the FcRn antibodies, which would have been a very important competitive threat, just in part due to the ease of administration of IL-6 antibodies, very straightforward sub-Q injections, whereas the FcRn's volumes are much higher and so harder to deliver sub-Q. But what we heard from Shugai and Roche was that while the trial was positive, it didn't hit the bar that they were looking for in terms of efficacy. They didn't share any details. I'll wait for a medical conference. But it certainly seems to have put a little dent into the IL-6 biology thesis, certainly for myasthenia gravis. And so you saw all the other MG and FcRn players trading up fairly meaningfully on the news. And then a company, Tourlamine, who is also working on an IL-6 antibody. Their focus is thyroid eye and atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, traded down in sympathy with that update. So it's caused a little bit of confusion in terms of what we can really expect going forward from the IL-6 class. You know, they clearly have very good activity in rheumatoid arthritis. There were important therapies for a little window during COVID, and still trying to figure out where they're going to potentially fit in or not. So that was kind of one of the big news updates this week.
And then I think, like, in terms of, like, what's next for this space, I know a lot of people are watching Biohaven's program. So they're doing an IgG degrader. And I interviewed them at JP Morgan. And if I remember right, I think their initial human data is supposed to be sometime this spring. I'm just wondering if you or any of our other panelists have any opinions or thoughts on, you know, this is one of many areas where degraders seem to be, like, of high interest. And any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting emerging program. Kind of the new Biohaven, after they sold the migraine program to Pfizer, has a number of interesting assets, including the degrader platform that basically targets IgG to the liver for degradation, and it can be adapted for IgA as well. So we've seen some pretty encouraging preclinical non-human primate data from that program, and this year we'll get a look at what it can do in patients and be able to line up its competitive positioning versus some of these other modalities.
Cool. And I actually asked Argenx about that, like, if they, what, how do they think about competition? And their feeling was they feel like this is one of those areas of medicine that's been so underserved that it would be a good thing for everybody, including them, if, you know, more things reach the market and there's more awareness of and more options for these patients. So we'll have to see how it goes. Another data set that was in the news, San Diego company, Crinetics. So they have paltusotine, and this was a phase 3 study in acromegaly, which is like a pituitary gland disorder. Tell us about that.
Sure. So acromegaly is currently treated with somatostatin analogs that generally require deep IM injections, which can be painful. And so Crinetics has come up with basically an oral version for patients. They've reported very positive data from their first trial in acromegaly a couple of months ago, and that this was kind of the next data set, just slightly different patient population. But again, kind of knocked it out of the park. Very, very active, very well-tolerated therapy. And so it really puts it on the path towards likely approval towards the end of next year. I think for me, what's so interesting about Crinetics is that it really is the best is yet to come type story. Paltusotine is going to start in acromegaly and carcinoid syndrome. Then they have an oral ACTH inhibitor for treatment of congenital adrenal hyperplasia and Cushing's syndrome. We're going to get a look at some early data in the second quarter of this year. That could be an even bigger drug. Behind that, entering the clinic, they have a PTH inhibitor for hyperparathyroidism. That could be an even bigger drug. And then behind that, they have oral drugs for thyroid eye disease and obesity. And it also highlights one of the attractive elements of endocrinology innovation. First of all, not a very crowded space, but it's a very facile space to innovate in because you have very robust biomarkers that you can measure even in healthy volunteers to get a very clean read of a drug's efficacy profile. And oftentimes, those biomarkers that you're looking at in phase one are the exact same biomarkers to support approval in registration phase three trial design. So it's not a lot of uncertainties, not a lot of guesswork, and there's not a lot of competition. And there is a high degree of unmet medical need in the endocrine space, and just kind of small handful of pioneers in this field, which is, I find, surprising given how attractive endocrinology is for innovation.
All right, thank you. I'll come back to you in a bit. I want to switch over to Eric. And Eric, it's always nice when we start the week off with M&A. And we had some M&A in a space where there's been a lot of M&A lately, radiopharmaceuticals. So this is AstraZeneca acquiring Fusion.
Yeah, indeed, Brad. I mean, I think it had been a couple of weeks, and anytime you go through a couple of weeks spate of no M&A, folks get a little bit nervous. But you're absolutely right. Radiopharm has been an extremely, I guess, hot area for pharma M&A. This is actually the third transaction that we've seen in the space in the last 5 or 6 months. Things kicked off with Eli Lilly buying Point Therapeutics in, I think it was in October, and then RayzeBio was acquired by Bristol shortly thereafter. And this week's news, of course, Astra purchasing Fusion for about $2.5 billion. So sizable transaction for sure. And for whatever reason, I think this is an area of pharma interest. I think generally speaking, when what we hear is that pharma is a little bit naive about radiopharm, and certainly a little bit maybe cautious about trying to build such a strange, if you will, development and discovery and distribution system that's very orthogonal to anything that it's got internally here. So they seem to be thinking that acquisition is the right way to build as opposed to try and create this internally. I guess the question I have, maybe for the group's broader debate and discussion, is what is pharma actually buying here? It's unclear to us that radiopharm is going to move outside of the, one or two targets that are of high interest today. Those would be PSMA and SSTR2, which are relevant in just a couple of tumor types, notably prostate cancer. And it's also unclear to us that any of these newly acquired companies are going to displace the market leader in Pluvicto, which has extremely good data in prostate cancer.
Hi, all. This is Brad. Can you hear me? I think many of us lost the audio.
Back on now. I don't know if others.
Yeah, I can hear you. I thought it was me on my side. So thanks, Brad.
Okay. Eric, are you still with us?
I am. Did I get cut off?
Yeah, I think we all did. You're kind of just saying that all these companies might not displace Pluvicto.
Yeah, I guess from our standpoint, Pluvicto is a great drug, first and foremost. And in order to be a even superior radiopharmaceutical, you need to have a better binder, a better linker, and a better radioisotope, a better payload. Those are the components of the mixture here. And what these pharma companies are actually buying when they purchase some of these smaller radiopharm companies today is still a little bit unclear to me. So I don't know if this is sort of, you know, pharma all of a sudden piling into an area where they know there could be potential innovation, or whether they really know what they need and have a strategy put together to create a truly better Pluvicto. But maybe others have a view on that.
Maybe I'll jump in on that. I mean, we've kind of seen these waves, right, of TKIs to ADCs, now radiotherapeutics, and you wonder if companies are starting to learn the lesson of it's better to get in early, so you pay, you know, a couple of billion for these new emerging technologies and gain access to the expertise and get a leg up on competitors and in what really is very complex drug development, and not waiting to pay $10 to $20 billion once the programs are de-risked. And so there is clearly a land grab effect happening here, just like we saw in the TKI space, just like we saw in the ADC space. So if you're pharma, maybe it does make sense to move in, you know, just recognizing the value and potential of the platform. For the most part, these aren't that big ticket type transactions, and you don't wind up sitting on your hands and having to spend 10x more down the road.
Yeah, I'll just add from the investor side. I mean, you know, we all know that cancer has had a little bit of an overhang, and, you know, people have had less and less confidence in the translational power of preclinical data. And I think for me, it's really a modality issue and the feeling that it's maturing in terms of how to kind of use this radionuclide modality, and that you're taking away some of the risk of the target engagement. I completely agree, Eric, on the, you know, we still need to find good targets and better targets, but I think there's a feeling that you can have more predictable target engagement, maybe dose window, and that, you know, this is an area that has matured somewhat and, you know, has more maturity to go. But I think it's a bet on modality. I think you're right. I think, you know, the products themselves don't justify this frenzy, but I do think the sentiment has, you know, just as you would have some go down in certain areas, you know, I think you've got, you know, this modality moving up in value.
Chris, I have a question for you about this. I mean, one commonality among these three companies for sure is that they were early in making investments in their own manufacturing facilities. And that's been highlighted by like all three of the acquirers. And a couple of weeks ago, I was talking with Andy Schwab from 5AM Ventures, and he was talking about a radiopharmaceutical company that they were just launching. And I said, are you building out manufacturing? And he said, no. And he said, the reason was he views this a lot like the gene therapy field. He was like, the early gene therapy companies all had to build out their manufacturing. And then over time, contractors were able to do that. And I know you were an investor in Forge, which is a, you know, service provider and manufacturer to gene therapies. I'm just wondering if you kind of agree with that in this space. It's a little, you know, you're talking about radioactive materials.
Yep.
It's a little different, but what do you think of that?
Yeah, I do. I think you're spot on. I think part of it is, you know, when we, you know, conduct our due diligence, right, you know, for the majority of companies, it's really around, you know, do you have the right target? What's your biology to prove that mechanism, right? How are you differentiated if you've already got other modalities in play? you know, for radionuclide therapy, it was really all of the other questions, right? It was like, how are you going to manufacture this? And how do you deploy this? And how do you, you know, do quality control? And like, how do you scale this up? I mean, a lot of it was very similar to many of the due diligence questions around, you know, gene and cell therapy, where you spend a lot more of your time and attention figuring out, can you actually do this, and less around the scientific thesis. The scientific thesis is always there, right? And, you know, we'll live and die by how compelling the data is. But this was one I think people had to overcome their concerns about this specific type of modality. So I think the analogy is good in that there's, a comfort level that either pharma feels that, okay, we can control this moving forward more readily, or the know-how is there to do this right.
Okay, I'm going to go back to you, Eric, on some news. So we have a new most expensive drug in the world. So Orchard Therapeutics, the gene therapy that was approved for metachromic leukodystrophy, will have a wholesale price of $4.25 million. This is obviously a very rare disease. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, dubious distinction for sure, right? So this is a good drug. Let's first give Orchard and this company was subsequently acquired or recently acquired by Kiwahaka. Let's give them credit for developing a good agent. Lenmeldi, as they're calling it, used to be called OTL-200, has shown quite good efficacy in a very rare and very severe genetic disease, metachromatic leukodystrophy. So I do think this is going to be a drug, much like the other more expensive drugs or the other somewhat almost as expensive drugs that came before it. I think this is going to be a drug that does have a substantial impact to patients. And I think in the U.S. there are only about 40 or 100 children with this disease each year. So, you know, this is rare of the rare. But the price tag is what caught most folks' attention this week. It's $4.25 million, as you noted, Brad. So this has the new distinction of setting a high watermark for pricing. The previous mark was set by Hemgenix at $3.5 million for hemophilia. That was priced last year. And, you know, I think this all started with Zolgensma, another gene therapy for a rare disease that back in 2019 for the treatment of SMA was priced at about $2 million. So, you know, we thought Zolgensma was pretty crazy back then. And now just 5 years later, we've got a product on the market that's more than 2x Zolgensma. So I guess the question is, where does this kind of trend end? And Chris, I know you must have some views on expensive drug pricing. So why don't you chime in?
Yeah, look, I think to put this one into context, it is a high sticker price. It is whack. And I think a lot of people don't understand the nuances of when you announce your wholesale acquisition costs, that's not really your effective price that you get, that the company gets. But also, you know, with gene therapy, we've had this debate for a long time. You know, just going back to, you know, Sarepta, you know, when they announced the price of Sarepta, they used a net price that was kind of an effective discounted that they were projecting. And they were kind of touting $300,000. That was for a low weight patient that was consistent with the weight in their clinical trial. But in reality, their WAC was closer to, you know, 1.2 million, but that is a, you know, oligonucleotide annual cost. And there was an article that was just put out about the Duchenne money that's been spent on the drugs that have still not shown confirmatory studies. And it was, you know, a couple billion, you know, I think the Eteplirsen's generating about $400 million a year, maybe a little bit more. And so when you add up the annual costs of those drugs with modest benefit, it adds up to $4.25 million pretty quick, number one. And number two, this is one of those ultra rare. And I agree. I mean, they did a great job. You know, Orchard had struggled. I think it was probably on the list of those companies that might not have survived. And so, you know, I think $4.25 million for an ultra rare, I think their press release highlighted that they think there's going to be an incidence of 40 children annually. So, you know, even if you took that 40 children at the WAC price, you know, that's, you know, $150 million, let's say, annually. So, you know, this isn't going to break the bank, but I think it raises the issue of Zolgensma had a much higher prevalence, right? And so, you know, are we making the right comparisons here? Are we just responding to the sticker price, right? And you really have to look at the totality. Is it a gene therapy? Are there good rebate systems in place as they signaled in their press release? You know, how much will a single product actually gain over 10 years, right, versus a chronic? So I think it's a worthy debate and discussion the industry should have around this, but to not focus so much on the sticker price, because, you know, you look at, you know, we were supporting Francis Collins was really interested in progeria. And I think at the time there were, you know, about, you know, 16 patients in the U.S. and he wanted to work with our technology. We're like, yeah, of course, you know, we're not going to do the calculation that are we going to make enough money off of this? But, you know, if you had a cure for a ultra rare disease like that, then, you know, 4 million doesn't sound like that much. So I think we have to kind of scale this the right way. And for sure, we shouldn't be comparing a one and done, you know, curative type of gene therapy price point with an oligo, you know, that might be, you know, half a million or a million, that's going to be used chronically. So that's the perspective. But, you know, I think it's something to watch. The only other thing I'd say is that, you know, rare disease was in the news on some other things this week as well. There was a new orphan accelerator kind of model that was started by Craig Martin, who was the CEO of Global Genes. They're trying to take all of the programs that are ultra rare that have been kind of abandoned, you know, true orphans, nobody's funding them, and trying to come up with a new model. You know, this has somewhat been tried before with Cyden. Bridge Bio was kind of founded on, you know, focusing on multiple, you know, rare disease programs. Taysha, which was kind of the one of the reasons for this new model, you know, had 16 plus programs, and then they only had enough money to advance, you know, a couple of them. So I think the rare disease sector is still struggling, but people recognize that there's still a lot of interest. You can still get drugs approved on small trials. You got the Amylyx thing, you know, hanging over us, you know. And so I think it's a sector to watch and to figure out. And even Stat News had a new article about how the state reimbursements are trying. The pharma is pressuring state reimbursement authorities to exempt rare disease and orphan drugs, you know, from their price caps. So, you know, I think rare disease is still working itself out, even though it's a pretty mature therapeutic area. You can still see people are trying to figure this out, you know, highlighting priority review vouchers as a way to get monetization of ultra rare disease. So anyway, I just think it's an interesting area as the market has pivoted toward some of these other cardiometabolic, immune inflammatory disease, you know, CNS, we're seeing a return back to kind of, you know, old guard therapeutic areas. And it'll be interesting to see where rare disease fits into that moving forward.
Chris, I have a question. One of the things I always wonder about is we see this huge wave of gene therapies coming to market, especially the quote unquote one and done. You know, we still don't have long-term durability data, and depending on the modality and how these things are done, you know, it could be interesting to see how the funding model evolves, both in terms of the regulatory requirements and what's needed there. So those hurdles need to change so we can get more of these treatments more rapidly into patients, but then also kind of downstream, the true health economics. And be able to capture that. It may be that the bar changes for some types of modalities a little bit in terms of durability and long-term efficacy. And it may, you know, there may be other factors, but there's so many in the pipeline. Like at some point, there's going to have to be a reckoning, and we need to change how we look at the system, like you said. So I'm curious if you've thought about the long-term durability aspect of that.
Yeah, well, there's two takes on it. Well, first, I do think that the FDA has done a pretty good job of requiring longer term, right, follow up. And it's hard with one and done because the patients aren't committed, right? They've already got their therapy. But I think Lynn Meldy had like 6+ years of some follow up on patients. So, you know, I think from a safety standpoint, it seems like the regulators are doing the right job holding the sponsors' feet to the fire. I think this is the two takes on this are despite hundreds of gene therapy programs that have been touted, even by the FDA, of being proud how many gene therapy programs there are out there. Peter Marks signaling that he wants to do accelerated approval for gene therapies, et cetera. We just haven't seen that many drug approvals. We haven't seen that many that have really made a big impact in terms of the number of patients that could benefit. We've seen somewhat, equivocal, durability and responses. So I think many are saying, wow, we don't really have to worry yet because we're, it's just not living up to the expectation of, gene therapy was going to, just be this, transformational modality for medicine at large. The other argument is, look, for those that do get approval, get the best price you can because it's not an issue right now. It's not a problem. They'll do discounting and I would encourage everybody to read the Orchard press release because it really goes into all their patient services and all their, willing to work and have value-based and innovative outcomes agreements and, surrounding the actual WAC price and highlighting how few patients there are. So someone who could read that could really calculate that, all right, this isn't going to break the bank. But so I think that for those companies, it's going to be in their best interest or fiduciary to, maximize the value. And they even referenced an ICER where it said up to, I haven't looked at the ICER analysis, but even justifying up to 3.9 million might be justifiable. So they aren't that far away and they're probably going to be with a net price of less than that if that ICER quote is true in their press release. So, but I think you're right. I think everybody's waiting for, what if we have, 100 gene therapies that are all charging millions of dollars? I think we're going to see solutions long before that. And frankly, IRA might, be encroaching on that. And obviously there's a lot of political will to, control these prices. So I think it just hasn't become a big enough target in my mind to create that political will around gene therapy specifically.
This is Eric. To Grace's question about sort of the healthcare economic benefit here, I do want to give a quick shout out to Bluebird Bio, which has a couple of drugs on the most expensive list, namely Zynteglo for thalassemia and more recently Lyfgenia, the cell therapy for sickle cell disorder. And Bluebird's really pioneered, I'd say, an innovative and creative solution to drug pricing, which is to look at outcomes in patients with these hemolytic anemias and provide rebates to the healthcare system for those patients who are not achieving good longer-term outcomes in the form of being transfusion-free or transfusion-independent. So it's not easy what they're doing. I'm sure it's ridiculously complex to keep track of the revenue recognition and patient trajectories over time. But at least we're starting to move in that direction. And to my knowledge, they're the first and maybe only to try to take this on. So good for them.
Yeah, great point. And I do think that we can learn from some of these early experiments and make it in a way that's scalable and works for everybody. And we kind of have to, right? Because when all this innovation is coming to fruition and there's a lot of unmet needs. So we kind of have to match everybody's expectations. So I agree, the Bluebird model is really interesting.
Okay, let's move on. And Grace, I'm going to go back to you. Something that we talked about last week, but people are still talking about a lot this week and trying to figure out is the fallout from the BioSecure Act.
Yeah, thanks for that. I thought the discussion last week was really interesting. Obviously, I'm a member of the executive. Hello?
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, and I'm on the executive board of Bio. So, I can share a little bit of perspective. I don't want to speak. I got to be careful because I don't want to speak in the name of Bio. But what I can communicate is it's interesting. BioCentury came out just last night with a poll they did to really understand the potential impact, particularly on small companies, of if this legislation comes to pass. So one of the questions was, would switching away from China-based CDMO slow down development of your pipeline? 64%, it would substantially slow down their pipeline, with 28% saying a minor slowdown. So fewer than 10% that it wouldn't affect it at all. And it's really, really hard. I think a lot of times when there are political decisions that are made very quickly, the fallout then has to be cleaned up. So I think there's a lot of work ahead of us in terms of understanding the longer term implications. And I think from a political standpoint, I think it's important that we remember and note that there's a lot of stuff going on with regards to biosecurity in the intelligence community that the average person and we aren't privy to. And I thought it was telling that this was an overwhelmingly bipartisan committee vote after seeing some pretty detailed intelligence briefings. And so there may be stuff going on here. I don't want to speculate. I just know that there's probably more behind this than we're really hearing overall. And regardless of that, I think there's a broader trend with regards to concerns about infrastructure to the nation. So we've seen all kinds of reports of the risk of cybersecurity attacks on whether it's the electrical grid, the water, and so forth. And so I think we're seeing a little bit of fallout from that. On the flip side, it's really interesting because I think this is a real opportunity. It's, you know, you got to make lemonade out of lemons. I think it's an opportunity to more deeply engage with Congress and legislators about the complexities of the biotech ecosystem, because on the one hand, they want to build up biosecurity, they want to be more independent, but yet they're sort of completely cutting off our legs as an industry, at least in terms of a drug industry, with the IRA and a number of other moves. So you can't have it both ways. You can't go out there and announce a cancer moonshot and all this new investment for unmet needs like women's health and rural health and not look at the bigger picture. So I do think there is an opportunity to engage and educate as well as really build up infrastructure here. Now, of course, if this legislation comes to pass, and there's an expectation that it will, it's very likely that it will, we do have to at least manage the transition. We have to be pragmatic and work with companies and work with, find exceptions so that there's enough transition time for companies to move away. But one of the first things we talked about as Bio was, yeah, this will impact exactly as BioCentury said. This is going to, unfortunately, if companies look at it, investors look at it, it's a devastating blow. And so we have to find a way to transition. Personally, from a geopolitical standpoint, it really concerns me. I think I mentioned a couple of biotech hangouts ago that the there's a fantastic McKinsey article or Economist article about a McKinsey study that really measured geopolitical distance and trade and how it's more extreme than ever between the U.S. and China. It's no surprise, but they actually looked at things like UN votes, and then they looked at amounts of trade and different factors impacting sort of the health of the economies of various countries. And this is just going to add another wedge, which really concerns me, because I think, as Tim said, patients are patients everywhere. Healthcare is universal, and we should be banding together. And we're seeing this all across the board with respect to China. I'm also on the board of trustees at MIT, and seeing the impact on Chinese, professors of Chinese descent and students who are having visa troubles, they can't go back home. And these are brilliant students from the best universities in China. These trends personally worry me a lot, but at the same time, we have to work with Congress. We're subject to legislation. And so we have to find a careful balance of how we work through this and while meeting the needs of patients and of companies and also trying to leverage it as an opportunity. So I know, Chris, you had some thoughts on all of this as well.
But I would encourage the audience, if they didn't listen to last week's, because Brad, you did a good job, and the whole group, Daphne, really tackled this as it was just emerging as a real issue. And so I just wanted to highlight, look, I think Grace hit on a lot of key points. In some ways, even though the BioCentury poll, I don't know how skewed that is to biotech versus pharma professionals specifically, but I'm really highlighting that because you've got, commercial supply issues that would be the most immediate impact on patients. And I just don't know given a lot of pharma companies are multinational, a lot of them have their own offshore manufacturing, are not, you know, presumably less reliant on a WuXi than biotech development stage organizations. But to highlight that, you know, John Crowley, in some ways, I was encouraged that, you know, he kind of knows his way around Washington. I think he ran for Congress at one point. You know, he's been involved in, you know, politics for a while. So I think the calculus must be that, look, if we're going to have credibility as an industry and have a real seat at the table, we have to support some of these broader meta themes, in this case, China, that might even hurt us in the near term, in the hopes that we can gain leverage with, you know, legislative power on things that, you know, are on the table that we can actually influence and make sure we have somebody who understands. And John Crowley's clearly, you know, from his experience 20 plus years as a CEO, you know, having rare disease patients himself, that motivated him to build Amicus. And he even highlighted, I believe, that Amicus is almost solely reliant on WuXi. So he, his own company that he founded and has a vested interest in, is impacted directly. So he clearly wasn't acting in kind of a self-serving mode. And so the other thing I'll mention is that, you know, he was criticized, Bio was criticized by Mike Gallagher, who's a Republican out of Wisconsin. Well, you know, he's joined by Jake Auchincloss, who's a Democrat out of Massachusetts, who has pedigree in biotech, his parents, and he knows this industry really well. And he was the co-author, right, of this bill. So I think clearly Grace is probably right. There's probably more here than we realize. And the thing I'm hopeful for, even though there's going to be near-term pain, is that this hopefully will mobilize, you know, other service providers, other suppliers. Grace and I are part of this biotech CEO forum group. And one of the members said, look, we created this problem. We became so reliant and we, you know, bolstered, you know, biotech was outsourcing so much to China that we built these behemoths. And, you know, we really didn't create a lot of backups. So I hope this will spur, you know, some kind of, you know, domestic interest in making, having, you know, other supplier sources for manufacturing. And the last thing I'll say is it is unfortunate because if truly this is about genetic information and harvesting genetic information from, you know, U.S. citizens, you know, there's a lot that can be done with China that doesn't involve that. And it would be nice if there would somehow be some kind of carve outs. And Brad, I remember, wasn't there a carve out at one point during the Trump administration and some of the trade issues for biotech? And maybe I'm hopeful that, you know, Congress can figure out the appropriate, you know, carve outs in this situation.
Yeah, I don't know. I will say this. One of the things that my opinion that I shared last week is that this is just the beginning and it's going to go far beyond just like CROs, CDMOs. And there's actually a story in the news today about how some Congress people are starting to call for export controls on just like everything, like standard licensing deals and selling drugs into China. So I think this is just the beginning and we'll probably be talking about it a lot more, but let's switch topics since I think we've covered that well. Grace, I'm going to go back to you. You know, you mentioned just now like the Cancer Moonshot and programs like that. And there was something in the news this week. So President Biden signed an executive order to bolster research specifically for women's health. Can you kind of set the stage here and maybe describe what the unmet need is and if you think that this executive order will, you know, really accomplish something?
Yeah, thanks, Brad. I mean, this is a drop in the bucket, but it's a good start. And I should point out, to set some context, like you said, there's been a lot of momentum, particularly over the past year. So this executive order was announced on Monday, and specifically, and of course, it was timed with Women's History Month, it was specifically calls upon the NIH to invest $200 million in the 2025 fiscal year into more than 20 new actions to address gaps in women's health research. And this is going to target broadly issues that are unique to women, such as menopause, perimenopause, endometriosis, and others, you know, related to kind of gynecological and reproductive health. But it will also address things like heart attacks, Alzheimer's, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoporosis, a lot of other treatments that disproportionately affect women or impact them in a different way. And this is going to be done through HHS, Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs, and NSF. So a number of departments are getting involved, but this comes on the heels of a bunch of other stuff. So last year, for example, in October, something called the Innovation Equity Forum, sponsored by NIH, Office of Women's Health Research, and the Gates Foundation, did a remarkably broad and big effort putting together what they call the Women's Health Innovation Opportunity Map. And if you Google that, you can find it online. The full report is there. And they identified 50 opportunities to advance global health, as well as some funding opportunities through Gates Foundation. And I think one thing that they did really well to your question about setting the context of the unmet need is so huge, I almost don't even know where to start. But I think part of the problem is historically, there's been very little research specifically in women's health. And by that, 1% of the $200 billion spent annually on R&D is invested in women's health, which is really atrocious considering women are more than half the population. But part of it is a number of things, such as really kind of understanding conditions that affect women disproportionately, like autoimmune. And lately, we've seen a huge, huge uptick in that with major funding events and IPOs in that area. So more to come. But also conditions that affect women differently. So cardiovascular, mental health, all of those things impact women differently and have been poorly studied. Historically, I think after the thalidomide scandal about 60 years ago, women of childbearing age were excluded from research. And so I think there's not enough statistics or assessment of how sort of broad chronic drugs impact women. And some analyses have shown that drugs that are presumed to be effective, whether it's cardiovascular, respiratory, others, actually aren't as effective as in women, and they haven't been properly studied. So this is a huge problem. It's not just what a friend of mine calls bikini health, which is reproductive and fertility, but everything else. And the other problem is it's a very disparate channel. So you've got different specialties, you've got different age groups of women where the conditions that are more important vary tremendously by age. So you've got sort of the puberty years, the fertility years, the maternity, you've got all these different issues, and it's very fragmented. And on top of that, it's not just drugs. Female specific conditions in particular, you're talking about everything from medical devices, diagnostics, therapeutics, et cetera. And because there's been very little research on the therapeutic side, women's health is kind of like the earliest days of cancer. So I'm a severe endometriosis patient. I could talk for hours about that, but I've probably cost millions to the healthcare system. And that's because it's poorly diagnosed, poorly treated, and has long-term consequences that I can go into in some other forum. But it's being treated like the early chemotherapy days, where it's just this broad brush hammer and you're flooding the body kind of indiscriminately. And until we actually invested in understanding molecular pathways, for example, endometriosis has tons of molecular subpathways that are just beginning to be understood, you can't develop targeted drugs. So until you invest in the fundamental research and actually identify some targets, then you're not going to see the outcomes of that in drugs until 10, 15, 20 years later. So I think I'm just giving you examples of some of the gaps. So after that big report came out, and I highly encourage people to look at it because it's one of the best explanations I've seen. In November, First Lady Dr. Jill Biden launched the White House Initiative on Women's Health Research, which was kind of a broad announcement. They didn't have specific goals other than there's a number of goals that they outlined. And the first thing that came out of that was the ARPA-H announcement that came out a couple months ago, where ARPA-H is committing $100 million to accelerate women's health research. And this is across the board. It's not just therapeutics. It's all kinds of different things. And they've outlined a number of areas. And there's actually grants due on the 15th of April. I'm working with a couple of companies on these. So that'll be a start. And then you have, a number of other investors coming into the space. Google Ventures has had now for a couple of years a group focused specifically on therapeutics. There's been a lot of focus on reproductive health, especially in light of what's going on. Next week, the Supreme Court will be hearing the mifepristone oral arguments, and I think we've spoken about that here before. And so I think there's going to be a coalescence of interest groups who are really trying to appropriately identify and quantify the problem so that we can then begin to address it at its core. And it's on both ends. It's fundamental biology. And on the other end, it's appropriately capturing the health economics. So you could have a sustainable reimbursement pathway and actually attract big pharma and attract investors. So at Bio, I was involved in instigating a women's health task force, and that is up and running. And a number of other coalitions are being formed to try to tackle this problem and start getting funds directed to the right areas. What's interesting is digital health investors have invested like $3 billion in women's health, they say, but it's all apps. It's primarily an app to help track your period or to help things. And those are all great, but it's not going to really solve the problem. And so I'm hoping that some of that enthusiasm for digital health and women's research will start turning to actual well thought out problems and solutions. So that's pretty much it. You know, happy to answer any questions, and people, please reach out to me online if you want to talk more about any of this. It's a very exciting area.
Any comments from anyone else?
I think when it comes to women's issues, Grace is probably the expert on this call.
I'd agree. Right.
We have a lot of male allies. I have to say John Crowley at Bio is an avid participant in the Women's Health Task Force, and there are a number of others. So, you know, men are welcome to participate as well. You all have women in your lives that you love. You know, this is important. Male investors need to be educated as well. One investor, one of the companies I chair, one investor said, how many times a year do women menstruate? He didn't even know. Okay, so that's the magnitude of the problem. I hear some clapping in the audience. I mean, when you don't understand the fundamentals of female biology and you're the decision maker, that's a big problem. So we need more female leaders and decision makers.
Okay. Josh, I'm going to go back to you on a couple of topics. And one of them is, you know, we just had this advisory committee for the BCMA cell therapies. And the issue here is, like, they both have had stellar PFS data, and OS hasn't been as hot. In fact, Abecma flat out didn't hit overall survival at all on their confirmatory. And what the companies chalk this up to is the crossover, because patients are almost always naturally crossing over to the CAR-T arm if they weren't originally. And this is an issue that's like affecting other areas of drug development. Like, speaking of radiopharmaceuticals, I know some you know, big things like Pluvicto have come up against this issue. And I think you wanted to share some thoughts on it, so I'll pass it over to you.
Yeah, we've been having our own internal debate at Cantor over kind of the how one should be interpreting these trials. I mean, obviously, patients need to have the option to cross over to an approved therapy, but in effect, what these trial designs are testing, as you take an approved drug and try to move it up into earlier lines of treatment, is, you know, it's essentially a test of, you know, first line versus second line, or second line versus third line, you know, and trying to figure out if you've delivered meaningful incremental benefit to the patient by using a drug earlier in the treatment paradigm. Now, oftentimes the answer is an astounding yes. You can think of Tagrisso and the dramatic effect it's had in earlier and earlier lines of EGFR non-small cell lung cancer. But you also sometimes see these trial results. Probably one of the more dramatic ones recently is the PSMA-4 trial of Pluvicto, where using Pluvicto pre-chemo in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer actually had a negative overall survival effect. Now, Novartis made some adjustments for the crossover and kind of after making those adjustments implied that actually there was a beneficial effect on survival. But you know, at the end of the day, what that trial seemed to suggest is that some Pluvicto in that case and other drugs in other settings may be better served not moving earlier into the treatment paradigm, even if it looks like the PFS is better because you're not improving survival. And in some cases, you're actually making survival worse. And that it just all has to do with the risk benefit of a drug. And you know, no drug is perfectly clean. We all know they come with side effects, some more than others. And while some of these therapies can have a potent treatment effect, they can also have potent issues with safety, which in some settings would imply that they should be reserved for later lines of therapy. So I get very frustrated with these negative trials that get dismissed because, oh, well, patients crossed over, rather than framing them as trials of first-line use versus second-line use and whether you've actually improved the standard of care by moving what are very expensive therapies into earlier lines of treatment.
You know, maybe so I'm
curious to hear other thoughts on that, because that is a subjective debate.
I mean, Josh and I have been going back and forth on this earlier today, and I whiffed on our previous debate, so maybe I'll try and take him on this debate. And he's right. There are some real-world consequences that prevent us from maybe doing a more rigorous comparison. We have to do crossovers in these studies. So by nature of the crossover, the data are confounded and, you know, no trial is perfect. We never get an exact pure data set from anything we do in human being patients. But this is an issue that has confounded the ability to interpret some of these second line versus first line indications or third line versus salvage indications. And it's something that we're always going to have to deal with. I guess maybe my question would be even a higher one. What reason would you think that a second line Abecma or Carvykti patient would get a benefit, whereas a third line or fourth line patient wouldn't receive as much benefit or vice versa? I mean, these lines of therapy that the FDA has created to distinguish cancer indications are so artificial. You can give a patient a little bit of dexamethasone or a quick course of Revlimid and say, okay, they failed the line. And you know what? It's still the same patient. Carvykti and Abecma, the two drugs that were being debated last week, they're by far the most potent, the most efficacious drugs we've ever seen in myeloma. And the whole setup of whether or not they should move up a line in therapy is kind of silly to me, because it just doesn't seem like that's how medicine is practiced in the real world. Nobody necessarily, you know, counts every course or every line of therapy that a patient gets. We know from the earlier data sets that these drugs are extremely potent. And yes, we know that they have some side effect issues also. But why should we put everything through this?
Did we just lose Eric again?
Sorry. I'm still here. So.
Yeah, you've been in and out. We have like 1 minute. If it's okay, I'm going to go to Josh with one last thing, and then we'll close out. Sorry about that. Josh, one very quickly last thing that I know you wanted to talk about is I think you did a webinar with Bridge, and you know, we're all awaiting the Helios-B data from Alnylam. That is arguably like the biggest data set of like the first half. It was already delayed once, but I think it'll be here before we know it. What were your takeaways from your webinar?
Yeah, you know, we usually don't kind of promote the work we do at Cantor in this forum, but this to me was an exception, just because you know, Neil Kumar, the CEO of Bridge Bio, has really put together an exceptional company. And what's remarkable to me is, you know, just his readiness to tackle really difficult questions with just tremendous intellectual honesty, you know, tremendous transparency, deep thinking. You know, I've not been able to find a question that Neil really hasn't, either on his own or with his excellent team, driven very deep to understand. And you know, to me, it was just a remarkable overview of a number of drugs that Bridges put together, starting with acoramidis for TTR cardiomyopathy, which has a PDUFA date later this year, infigratinib for achondroplasia, which is looking quite good. They have a drug for autosomal dominant hypocalcemia that looks essentially de-risked, and all of these have blockbuster potential. They have a drug for limb-girdle that's looking very promising. They have a strong medicinal chemistry team that have developed what could be a very differentiated KRAS G12C inhibitor. And so, you know, a lot of companies shy away from the hard questions, and yeah, either because they haven't thought of them or because they just don't want to address them. But for those CEOs and leaders that really, you know, to the extent that they can, recognizing that we're not, you know, sometimes you have to protect data, but those who open the kimono and kind of share with us what they know, what they don't know, and, you know, do their best to set reasonable expectations, earn just a tremendous amount of credibility relative to leaders who may be a little bit more promotional, who may not take on the hard questions. So it was a standout interview with a standout CEO, and wanted to flag that.
Yeah, and he's been on Hangout before, and I've interviewed him a couple times for Biotech TV, and I have to say he's one of my favorites because he's just so knowledgeable, and like you ask him a question and it's just like flows. Yeah, really, you know, really smart guy. All right, well, we're coming up to the end of the show here, so I'll go around the horn for any closing comments, and I'll start with you, Chris.
Yeah, no, just one topic that we didn't have time to cover was, you know, we're seeing the return of the mega, you know, venture deals. And, you know, this one that was $400 million that had quite a splashy group of investors. And I kind of equate that as there's a lot of dry powder on the sidelines, more than we've ever had as an industry. They need to deploy that capital. And rather than place a bunch of smaller bets on less proven, less experienced management teams, people are piling in to give a lot more money to proven management teams. In this case, the Prometheus team that had sold a $10 billion plus company. So, you know, I think I'm not surprised by that trend. I think we'll continue to see some of these mega rounds.
Yeah, and I noted, I thought that was interesting news. And I interviewed Mark yesterday, and they haven't announced any targets or indications or anything yet. So it really is just a case of, these guys made us a lot of money last time. let's put some money behind them to do it again. Josh, any closing comments?
Yeah. Oh, I just want to flag, you know, Daphne's not here, but PureTech just committed to returning $100 million from the Karuna windfall that they got. And note that what I think it was like an $18 million original investment returned over $1 billion to PureTech. So, you know, again, just a great opportunity to highlight the innovation from PureTech that gave rise to that very successful outcome.
Eric?
No, I think the trend you just mentioned, Brad and Chris, on these mega rounds for folks who have done it before and had a great exit, as the team at Prometheus had, and now are raising $400 million, or, and this is the first such in this trend. We've seen this happening over the last 5-10 years now in biotech. It's an interesting one to watch, and I'm not sure that, you know, when we've entrusted groups that have had wonderful exits with big rounds of cash before, they've all gone on to do great things. But very curious to see what this team does. It's certainly a terrific group, and I guess the new company here is Meridor, so we'll be following that closely as they move forward.
Grace, I'll pass it over to you to close things out.
Sure. No, I mean, just following on the last few weeks, just overall, generally great news in biotech. I mean, I think we're going to see We're going to see these trends continue. But one thing that I certainly have my eye on just working with small companies is when are we going to start to see a real uptick in super early stage? And I'm hoping that this will, be a natural, things will flow downhill. And we're starting to see a pickup in the sort of seed Series A. But I know, Chris, that's your space. So maybe we can chat offline about that. The other thing is there was an interesting, I always read Tim's report, and there's an interesting paper in Lancet that came out last week that really highlighted the impact of neurological conditions, which is not no surprise, but it surpassed, the way they analyzed it, it surpassed cardiology as the leading cause of ill health worldwide. So I think we didn't talk too much about neurology this week, but I think that that's an area that we're all keeping our eyes on and new modalities there. I'm involved in a couple of companies that are in that space, and we're seeing some really exciting advancements. So that's one thing I'm going to be looking at this year, in addition to all the other things.
Okay, with that, we'll close things out. And again, as a reminder, we won't have a hangout next week for Good Friday, and we'll pick back up the following week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Brad.
Thanks.